What's poppin', everybody? Hello and welcome to Popcorn Culture. My name is Ben Carlin and I am your host. Here with me today is my brother Jay, who will be in every episode as a special guest.
Better known to the little colonels as Jazzy Jay.
As Jazzy Jay.
That's right. The other host of the
podcast. You got Jazzy Jay and Buzzy B.
Jazzy Jay in the house. Ben, do we have a corny joke today?
We don't.
No? Literally,
I'm unprepared. This is not a good moment for me.
This is the kind of
hosting. Hold on. I'm improvising.
Wow.
I'm going to be able to sort this out. Hey, Jay, here's a real question for you, though.
Yeah.
What say you if someone called up and said, we want to give you two a morning show?
Yeah.
Like a radio show in the morning.
Yeah.
Do you feel... Sometimes when I listen to radio shows in the morning, I'm like, these people are so remarkably talented in their ability to be entertaining
day after day. Are you imagining we're like some like shock jock duo who's like playing music as well? Or it's just like, we just want to give you guys like a block of time to talk.
Tell me more about the term shock jock.
Shock jock would be like any, like, not any, but often I would think like top 40... station where you just have two DJs and they're just like goofing off each other and ripping on each other and stuff.
That's sort of what I'm imagining.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because here's the thing. I'm thinking about like radio DJs and like how we record, you know, roughly an hour and a half worth of podcast content on the weekly.
Yeah.
These folks that show up to be morning show DJs are talking for like 5-6 hours.
Well, not continuously.
Not continuously.
Largely it's playing music.
It is. Fair enough.
They do tremendous hosting jobs and much on the fly. And must prepare more than we do, I imagine.
Yes. No, I personally just find it to be remarkable. I feel like there's always that sentiment that comes back where I think it's Ryan Seacrest who said it maybe, but like as soon as you think you could do a radio DJ's job, it means they're doing it extremely well. Like because the effortless nature at which they're able to just carry conversation about things that are completely relatable to large numbers of people is like a rather specific skill.
It is underappreciated, I imagine, because that's the nature of it. It's like the more it sounds regular and just like, oh, I think I could do this, that's the better job they're doing. That's how it's supposed to sound, nice and conversational. I know you're just using this as a stall tactic, but you look up the corny joke. I'll answer your question. Yeah. If and when the BBC calls and is like, hey, Popcorn Culture, Jazzy J and host guy, would you like to host a radio show here in the UK? I'd be like, well, yeah. I don't know why it has to be there.
Why the UK specifically?
I mean, yeah, why?
Jay, because we have those fantastic foreign accents.
That's right. You know, that's true.
This is a genuine question.
Yeah.
It's like, if you were in high school and there was like an exchange student or literally just a family that happened to move from the UK to America.
Yeah.
And their students enlisted at our Cape Spring High School.
Yeah.
And they had that quality British accent.
Yeah.
Is it the same effect if we were to go over there?
Right.
Like, would people be like, wow, is that an American accent?
Yeah.
Because I don't feel like we have a very romantic sounding voice.
Yeah. Is it romantic in the UK in the same way that like a British or Irish or Scottish accent would like feel romantic here in the States?
Yes.
I see. I've maybe already undermined my own point, but I suspect that it could depend where in America you're from, because it's not like an American accent is just...
Oh, yeah.
Across the table sort of thing. There's many different, you know, accents, even within states sometimes.
Yes, I think about that constantly. Like, America is effectively, like, there's a way you could almost look at it like it's 50 countries.
50 little countries.
50 little countries scattered all about. And, yeah, because I would say, like, the culture, the accent and everything, if you're in Texas versus Florida versus, you know, the Midwest or something, it's all going to be very, very different. Anyway, this isn't really a joke, but I do think it's funny.
Okay, you have a corny funny.
I have a corny funny.
Okay, tell me your corny funny.
Jay, a book just fell on my head, and I only have my shelf to blame.
Pretty good.
Yeah, right.
Pretty good.
Right. Yeah. It's the shelf's fault.
Yeah. Huh. That's like, it sounds like the sort of thing like your dad might arrange to happen just so he could rip this joke.
Right,
on you.
Right.
Like, oh, God, man, This book just fell on my head. I guess I only have my shelf to blame. Kids, did you hear? Hold on. Oh, honey, put it back.
Put it back on the thing.
Put it back on the thing.
I don't think they heard me.
Yeah.
They're not laughing.
Do you think there are modern day people our age who call their significant others honey like that? To me, like, I just did that as if, like, oh, yeah, this is what some dad would say to his wife.
Right.
Like, I am a dad. I have a wife. If I ever called Beth honey, that would feel the weirdest. It would feel so out of place.
Oh, yes.
Like, hun? No. Oh, I don't even like it.
It doesn't sound right at all. No, this is like a thing. I feel like when you're in a relationship and the first time you like go to like drop one of those pet names.
Yeah.
Would be like, so I frequently will call Alice babe. And that I do remember the first time that I did it, it was almost like it like kind of like came out where I had like thought about saying or like referring to her by like a term like that before. And then it almost like I had spent so much time thinking about it in my head, like, could I do it? Can I pull it off? Like, is it gonna sound normal or is she gonna respond to it well? Mm. And I think I was just like in the car and was like, you know, can you open this bottle for me or something? Because we were like on a road trip. And it was like, babe, could you open this?
Did that work?
Did that feel normal?
Yeah, it's one of those. That's just faith.
It's just faith.
You just throw it out there, and you just gotta. Who knows where it's gonna land?
No, this is like exactly. We're talking about it. I think last week on the pop, where whenever I make like a big life change, I almost always have to do it as if like this funny thing I'm gonna do, like grow a beard or dye my hair.
Yeah,
it's like
you couldn't quite do that there.
And that was the thing. It was
would it be funny if I called you babe?
Can we be that couple?
Oh my gosh.
Babe, what do you think? Like,
I'm gonna do it.
We're there.
I do think because Beth and I also use the term babe.
Okay.
Does Alice call you that sometimes as well?
She does.
Okay. So I wonder if babe is the current is like the modern day honey.
Oh, I see.
Because yeah, I feel like maybe it is. Because like when we were kids, I feel like our parents use the phrase honey. I don't know, maybe not a lot. It felt more common for adults to say that.
Now I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, now I don't know if I'm just remembering wrong. I do think they're like when I like the word babe has changed a lot since we were kids. Like when we were kids, like babe meant like really attractive girl, like what a babe, you know.
I don't know that I've ever said that sentence in my entire life.
No.
But you're right. It was more of a descriptor than a name. Yeah. So I don't know. That's interesting. Okay, so that's a question that we can throw out there to you guys is what do you call your significant other, if anything?
Yeah.
Or does it like morph at all?
It probably morphs. Yeah. Based on like the couple.
Right.
Stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's actually, I would say that. Originally, so I started calling Allie babe, and then, or this, I really don't call people by their name almost ever.
Mm.
So
why would you?
Right. Yeah. So I think even in this particular episode, I've referred to my wife as now babe, Allie, and Alice.
Yeah.
But like sometimes I'll even refer to her by her last name and just be like, Haynes, what you doing? Just, like,
did she keep her last name then or?
Well, I think she's going to change her last name. She hasn't done it yet.
Okay.
But we got married in January of 2020, and then, you know, sort of quarantining and all that promptly happened. And it certainly wasn't something that was, like, so high priority that it was worth, you know, like, going out and being in public or going to, like, a public building or something to get it taken care of. So.
Right.
As of now, I think she's just sort of, it depends on where we are. If we go to like a restaurant, she'll usually use Carlin.
Yeah.
And she'll say like, you know, Carlin party of two, which even that's a terrible example because we're not going to restaurants right now either.
Yeah.
So I don't know why.
What is even the point of last names during quarantine, you know?
It's no longer functional.
No longer a functional part of your identity. Abandon it.
I would say
now.
That I'm more Buzzy Bee than I have ever been Ben Carlin.
Wow.
That's just my new identity.
All right, so we've abandoned last names. However, first names, Ben. Last pop, we asked people to make acrostic poems of our first names.
Goodness gracious.
And we had people do it.
We had so many people do it. Oh my gosh. So we had tons of emails come in where people had gone through and acrosticized our names.
Acrosted.
Benjamin and... what is it?
Acrosted.
Acrosted.
No, that just sounds like accosted.
It does.
That's what I was kind of going for.
Right.
Yeah. You've accrosted me.
Well, maybe with some of these, that is the case.
Maybe. But,
no, they were really funny. We had tons of submissions. So we're going to read a few of them here today because I thought these just turned out so spectacular. Emma writes, this is for Benjamin.
Okay.
Beings enter narcissism just as mermaids initiate neurosurgery. pretty good.
So, okay, let's break it down. Beings under narcissism, just as mermaids. It makes it sound like when you're being really narcissistic, it is the same as every mermaid when they start brain surgery. Like, all brain surgeon mermaids are, like, so arrogant.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like,
I believe that's...
Like, this is a known thing about neuro-mermaids.
Right. Yeah. Yes. It's just like, oh, man. You're a neuro mermaid.
Yeah.
I know what that means.
Yeah.
Okay,
your ego's a little out of check. Okay, you're not... What are you, a neurosurgeon mermaid?
It just seems unlikely, honestly. Okay, so this was also from Emma. This is your name.
Okay.
Jam on narwhal's antenna, thaw hallucinations over nothing.
Oh.
Jam on narwhal's antenna, thaw hallucinations over nothing.
Now, I'm imagining the antenna means the horn. On the narwhal here.
Right, but although isn't the horn is actually a tooth, is it not?
It is a tooth, yeah.
That is the actual like name of the narwhal's horn.
It is their front left tooth that has it like grows in like backwards and then like curls around and comes out through the front. So imagine your tooth was really long and didn't come straight down, but instead curled backward and came out through your nose.
That is actually making like my teeth hurt.
Yeah, how would you talk? I guess you don't use the top of your mouth. It doesn't move, but
I don't like the idea of a tooth curling.
Like, imagine your tooth, you like turning around, like catching a tooth on the door, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no good.
No. But as such, it is possible that the front right tooth also does it. So you have like a bicorn.
Let me ask you this. Narwhal. Do you ever have the teeth anxiety dream?
Where I'm like losing my teeth?
Where like your teeth are like, they've like become soft or they're falling out or...
I know this is a really common one, but it's not one I suffer from.
You don't? Okay.
No.
Do you have a common anxiety dream? I get all of them. Every anxiety dream known to man.
The one maybe that I can recall the most is where I am trying to run.
And your legs don't work?
It's not that my legs don't work. It's that everything else in the world is happening at regular speed and I'm like, my legs are moving in like slow, my legs and gravity are acting on me in like slow motion. So I will like hit the ground and push off as hard as I can. And then I'll be like stuck in the air waiting to hit the ground again. And it'll just be like, I am like, my brain and my arms are just like, come move. Like you got, like you need to move. And like, it's like, it's going so slow. And it's like, if I could just get there.
Oh
yeah. That's the one I have.
Interesting.
Not actually, very often, but
man. Yeah. I have that
certainly
one.
Certainly plenty of times.
I have it's always my English class, but like I go through an entire semester of like my final year of college and I like skipped English class for like the whole semester and like the exams coming up. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I like started skipping this class, never went back, and now I'm going to fail because like I literally forgot that I had this class.
Yeah. Oh,
like that was the extent to which in my mind I'm like skipping it over and over and over that like I literally forgot about it.
Now that you mention it, I actually have had a series of dreams where I too will, it's also English class, yeah, where I will like just, I'll like go to it the first time and yeah, then it'll be like, weeks later, I'm like, oh my gosh, I just keep forgetting to go.
Yes, yeah. That's it. That's it exactly.
Ugh. Like, it's just not even on, but interesting. I think I've had like progress in that dream where like I've had that dream and then in future iterations of the same dream, I'll be like, this time I'm remembering and I will go.
Oh, interesting. So, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, no, this is like, I think really what it like goes back to for me is always that feeling that everyone else in the class was much more prepared for whatever was going on than I was, which was just such a massive feeling of insecurity.
Yeah.
Like it was like, if you like miss the first couple of days of class or like, I remember when I was in, I believe it was first grade, they had originally put me into like one English class or like writing class, and then they had like a more advanced writing class.
Yeah.
And I guess after the first like 3 weeks of school, they were like, oh, we need to put him downstairs in like the advanced class in first grade apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And so they literally like changed my schedule and like moved me to that other class. And during that time, that teacher who was teaching writing to those other students had gone over like all of these little like inside jokes, rules of the classroom, like things that I had no idea about.
Ugh.
And most specifically, there was the idea of the rough draft was introduced.
Oh.
And I remember,
and you missed it.
Yeah, and so I didn't know what a rough draft was. And so I remember they were like, okay, guys, we're going to like write a story about your dog, but it's okay. This is just a rough draft. Like just, you know, like whatever you want to put down, like we can go back and we'll fix it later. And in my mind, I was like, it never occurred to me that there was a scenario that you wouldn't deliver your best work on your first try.
Right.
So like the idea of a rough draft did not make sense to me. Like, am I intentionally making it messed up? Like, and that's the thing too. It wasn't even like grammar or the type of storytelling that I was doing. It was literally the way I was writing the letters. I was like intentionally making them like squiggly.
You were like,
and it was like, this seems like so much more work
to like make it rough.
That's
amazing.
Yeah. So that I was so confused as to what a rough draft was, and it made no sense to me.
Yeah. Well, I remember, yeah, the rough draft was something I think that throughout my English class career, various teachers would be like, all right, your first draft is due on Friday. And then, you know, the actual paper will be due next week or whatever. So they would like get your rough draft and then like mark it up and then send it back to you.
Right.
And to me, it was just like, I'll just make these corrections. Then I'm done.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
It was never like, okay, I've done more research. I've thought more about it. I want to rewrite these sentences or rewrite these paragraphs. It was like, I basically gave you my final draft and you corrected it for me. And now I will turn in that same thing with the corrections.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
Because it was like, why you want me to do the whole thing twice? Like, you know, this was, and it's like, I know what they're going for. And like, they're trying to make you do it so that you will like learn good habits and do rough drafts so that you can go back and make corrections and stuff and like rewrite it. And it's like the way they're doing it is not like an effective way, because it's like they're just making it work rather than like giving you like a finished product that you're proud of in a way. I feel like research papers in particular were plagued by this exact thing. It'd be like, now you have to turn in this paper and you have to make sure you have two sources. One has to be from a book. One has to be. And it was just like, you're just like, what is the point? Like, what do you mean? I'll just write the paper. Like you had to go find sources for the sake of the assignment, not because it like better informed your paper.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. No,
and you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. It was, and I remember doing that exact thing. And I remember in ninth grade, I was writing a research paper, and the goal was the assignment, basically, they would go through, the teacher had all of these like myths throughout history or like unsolved whatevers. And so I was given Bigfoot. And the purpose of my research paper was to prove that Bigfoot was real.
Right.
And like I was supposed to like write a paper with sources that basically like come to the conclusion that Bigfoot is in fact real.
Sure.
And yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about, where it was like, I spent several days. So she would give us like all this time in the library where we had like an entire week.
Yeah.
And all we were supposed to do while we were there is just research for your, whatever you were doing, Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot. And so I had to just look for books everywhere for anything that had any information on Bigfoot,
yeah,
just so that I could literally be like, yeah, so I use this textbook. It has one sentence about Bigfoot in it.
That was so often what it felt like I was doing, was like looking through books and be like, oh, I'd like, you know, get to the paper and be like, oh, right, I need a sentence from like, I don't have a source yet, so I need to go find a sentence from this book I can include.
Right.
Like, okay, here's my source or whatever.
Right. Yeah, and it's such a disjointed way of doing something, as to being like, you need to have three websites, three books, three interviews or something like with people. Yeah, like it's so like cart before the horse, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah,
where,
that's kind of exactly how it felt. It was very cart before the horse, like teaching.
Right, right. Yeah, so it was very, very bad. Backwards, like you weren't able to just actually try to go out and solve the problem, which is, it's so funny to me how literally as a profession now, what we do is write research papers literally every single week, back to back to back, and how through all of high school, I literally never understood
how it worked. Like, now that like, it's like, it's interesting because you're like, what we do is try and sell people fictional versions of fictional stories.
Right.
Like, here's what about this? And it's like, that assignment you just described, where it's like, yeah, try and sell me on this fictional thing based on research. It's like, that's almost exactly what we do.
Right.
It's like, what a great way to drum it up and still just, I remember that exact assignment. I had Atlantis, and I remember thinking like, this is just so, I don't get it. Like, you know.
Was there any part of you that was like, Atlantis isn't real, and so I don't know how to try to prove it to you that it is.
Yeah, or it was just, it wasn't maybe even framed in that frame, like, you should prove to me that it's real. It was just like, tell me why some people think Atlantis is real or something. I was like, okay.
Okay.
That was sort of, I think, my approach to it.
Is Atlantis something. Real?
I mean, probably, Ben. Have you seen the pyramids? What else is there?
I have absolutely no idea how they could be connected.
Yeah, that was the big basis for it. It was like the pyramids lined up with certain stars or something. And
That is interesting. Okay. Yeah. I'm sold.
There you are. Atlantis.
Atlantis.
You know, where all the mermaid neurosurgeons are.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's
just
exactly
out there being
it.
Cocky.
Yes. Speaking of,
okay.
I think from Simon Ross, we have another acrostics.
Okay. Acrossed me with it.
You've been acrossed. here is Jonathan. Jaunty, outstanding, naturally amazing, terrific, handsome, analytical, nice.
Ooh, 10 out of 10, Simon. Well done.
So this is a completely different direction where less of these words are connected to one another and they're all connected
to
your personality.
To me. Yeah. This person, yeah. I think, seems to, they're playing into my own neurosurgeon.
Yes, they are. Know.
Yeah. Tendencies.
Tendencies indeed.
Wow.
So, okay, this is an interesting thing. I feel like in our office for Super Carlin Brothers, we've had tons and tons and tons of conversations about self-assessment, personality assessments.
like personality tests.
Personality tests, yeah. Like where you would sit down and like they've got like Myers-Briggs, I think, is like the really, really famous one.
Yeah, or like the Enneagram.
The Enneagram.
Even Hogwarts houses to a lesser extent.
Right. Yeah, like so that's the thing. I get emails from people all the time where they'll like quote something that I said and they'll be like, LOL, and you think you're not a Ravenclaw. And it's like, I feel like the entire viewing community that like sees me through, you know, whatever my online character happens to be as very much that kind of thinker.
Yeah.
But then I feel like if you know me in real life, the assessment that Slytherin, I think, tends to fit a lot better to my actual, like, day-to-day personality.
Right.
You know, just my resting disposition, if you will.
Sure.
But who knows? I mean, it's like, it's so hard to fully comprehend yourself.
Oh, isn't it? That is the trick with so many like personality tests, is that like when you're taking them, you're like, if I answer it this way, how would that affect the results?
Right.
You know, like what are they trying to get at here?
Exactly.
Which
yeah,
is
yeah.
why like I really want like the personality tests to, you know, I want one where you cannot overthink that element of it at all, where it's like you're presented with a cactus. Does that make you think about red or yellow? And you're like, oh, geez, I have no idea what either of these would mean. I guess red? And it's like,
red?
You're this kind of person.
You are kidding me. You would go with red when fronted with a cactus?
Probably.
Really?
More than yellow.
Oh, no, yellow all day.
See, we're totally different.
Way different people.
Yeah, but yeah, so where you just have no idea where the questions are taking you, but it's like, no, this means things.
Yeah, okay, but, so here's the thing. So I was watching Moana yesterday while I was folding laundry, and there's that, like, really, really big moment where she's, like, out on the raft, and Maui has left, and she's, like, basically giving up, like, the mission.
Yeah.
When, like, her grandmother shows up as sort of, like, an apparition and, like, talks to her. And there's, like, it's a huge moment of self-discovery for Moana's character. Like, she, like, all of a sudden, all of the pieces of the puzzle start to fit together, and she, like, starts to realize, like, she understands who she is.
Yeah.
And to me, this is like one of the most powerful moments in like all of Disney movies for me as an individual.
Right.
And I think it's because I struggle with this very thing constantly.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like I have such a hard time figuring out who I am, what the perception of me is, what type of, like, I don't know, I don't have, like, all the pieces of the puzzle. There's so many unknowns.
Right.
And so, like, I operate in constantly, like, this, like, self-deprecating way where it's, like, I have to think negatively about myself because, I don't know. Like,
interesting.
To think positively about yourself is a great thing to do.
So,
but for me, I always feel like it's going to err on, like, some version of, like, arrogance or, you know, like, overconfidence.
Right. You don't want to be
confidence.
Don't want to be that mermaid, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Merman, sorry.
Baseline confidence. Is you've already reached the point of being arrogant. That is the way that my brain works, is you can't just be confident in yourself, because the moment you are, you have gone too far with
better
it.
To assume you just suck at everything.
Precisely. Exactly. Yeah. So this is something where I feel like my whole life I've always wanted to take one of these assessments, or like the Enneagram. I feel like is so interesting because you start hearing the characteristics be read aloud, and you do hear like these things that so perfectly explain why or how you think about things, and you're like, yeah. Oh my gosh,
right,
that is me.
It is, sometimes you get those results and it's like, it's a little too accurate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's interesting you brought up that moment in Moana and described it the way you did. I feel like I get the exact same feeling at the end of Frozen 2 when Elsa's like in the ice cave.
Yeah.
Like that I don't know why, what it, I don't know how it's different from that scene in Moana, which I love. That's like one of my favorite parts of the movie, where she's like, I'm Moana.
Right.
Yeah, really cool. But yeah, that moment, like, I don't know, that whole song where she's like, you know, going through the ice cave and stuff. It's like a very emotional experience for me. It's like, it's definitely tapping into something I very much feel. I'm like, man, I don't know what they're doing here, but it is like very real to me right now.
Okay. So I think this is interesting for a couple of things. So I want to add a small amount of Frozen 2 commentary. So like Frozen 2 is a strange situation where I so love the music. Like I think, yeah. I do think the music is better. Every time I try to go back, and I usually like fall asleep to Disney movies, I don't know if I actually like enjoy watching Frozen 2, the movie.
Oh really?
Yeah. Like it is, it's like, and I feel really weird saying that because I know it's like, it's a really great movie and I really like the music from it, but like the story doesn't get me mm-hmm. at all. But you're right. I think that we're comparing similar situations between like Moana's moment and Elsa's moment.
Yeah.
But I feel like there are, as soon as you were describing that, I'm like, what is different about me and your circumstances?
Right. That, yeah. Well, I was trying to think that too. So what do you think it is?
Well, okay. This is going to sound, this is not even going to sound like confidence level, Ben. This is going to sound like you left arrogance way in the past, but I feel like Elsa has a very like her family role is like a huge deal to her.
Right.
Like what she like represents to like the rest of mm-hmm. both the kingdom of Arendelle.
Like
and
who
also
she is versus what's expected of her.
Exactly. Yeah. Which I feel like would make a lot of sense for you because you're like an oldest sibling because you have three children, you know, mm-hmm. like, I don't know. Like you have these like areas of responsibility.
Sure.
I guess
yeah.
that probably are big things that I imagine would weigh on you in some capacity, whether it's like in a positive or negative way, they're mm-hmm. your key responsibilities.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like Moana is like the chosen one.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like that's like the like moment, I don't know, like that it's she also has a responsibility to her people and like to all that type of stuff and everything.
Right.
That is very like, I don't know if maybe that's part of the reason why it's different. Mm. Is because literally in my mind it's like, am I the chosen one?
Are you the chosen
am
one?
Am I the chosen one?
Are you like out on a raft singing like I Am Benjamin or
or like are you Neo programming and like the White Rabbit shows up or mm-hmm. are you Harry?
Most of those characters are like typically written so that the reader can feel like they are
that
the
person.
So this was an interesting thought I had the other day having read through The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes recently, which is the prequel story to The Hunger Games.
Right.
In case you don't know, that recently came out, and it tells the story of a young President Snow.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was making me think, like, some people think it's, like, really dark, and so I don't know if everyone loved it or anything. I liked it a lot, but it made me, like, really think a lot more about The Hunger Games itself. And it's like, it's like when I read The Hunger Games the first time, it was like, it was so easy to imagine yourself like as like the Katniss character, especially I think for us, because we're like, she's from like Appalachia basically. We're
yeah.
like, you know, we grew up in the Appalachian Mountains. Like District 12 is where we're from.
Yeah, we would live in District 12.
Yeah, we would live in District 12. It's like, yeah. Oh man, I could totally see it. Like, you know, you fight the Capitol and oh, it was just so cool. It was down in the woods. And it's just like, but I'm like reading it and it's like, it's very easy to imagine to put yourself in like the Katniss role or whatever. But I'm like, everyone who reads this I would say most people I would bet have no idea like what Katniss is like. If you're because here was my takeaway was that if you're reading The Hunger Games and you're rooting for Katniss to win, then you are effectively a capital citizen.
Oh, right? because you've become a part of the spectacle.
Right, you have become part of, like, you're
you
the fun.
You are watching The Hunger Games.
Yeah, you're, like, the fun, like, everyone loves the first Hunger Games, maybe not everyone. To me, the widespread consensus is that the first book is the best one.
Sure.
And the second one, it kind of goes in order. I don't know, maybe you have your own opinions, but to me, it seems like general consensus is that The Hunger Games is great. Catching Fire, also pretty good. Mockingjay, well, there's no games. It's not as much fun.
Well, there's no games until it, like, effectively there are games.
I know, but they're not, like, they're not even called games. It's just like, oh, I see, you've turned the Capitol into, like, an arena. Right. Sneaky, sneaky. But it's not, like, the first two books to me are so much more fun because it has the games, and the games are the fun part. That's what the book is about.
Right.
But it's like, you're watching the games. You're, like, you're rooting for her because she's your champion, you know? It's like when, like, really, if you're reading the Hunger Games and you're doing anything except rooting against the Capitol, if you're just, like, you should be reading it in disgust the whole time, like, oh, this, everything should be making you mad.
Right.
You know?
Right. Like, the very circumstances that they're put inside of.
Yeah. When, like, you know, when Katniss kills Kato or whatever, if, you know, that's like, if you're like, yeah, she did it! You know, it's like, that's not the right answer.
Well, I know, and I do feel like, so, with that, not to go so ridiculously deep into specifically the Hunger Games in case people are not, like, quite as tuned into that particular story, but I do feel like the way that, like, Katniss does kill Kato at the end is, like, out of mercy.
So, okay, maybe Kato is a bad example.
Sure,
because
sure,
at that point, you know, it's pretty obvious. Yeah, maybe at that point you're just like, oh, God, they've turned all the tributes into dogs and...
Right, yeah. Right.
And yeah, even Kato was sort of like, this is what they want. They want a show. And you're like, oh man, even Kato gets it.
Even Kato, he's like, oh man.
Yeah. But I don't know. At other points then, I guess, where she drops the tracker trackers on him.
Yeah. And, right. You know, right. Yeah. And
you're like, yeah, you did it.
You're exactly right. And there absolutely is that kind of like, that's part of the story too, is they do create these like jockish.
Yeah.
Type of, you know, the career pack.
Right. They make like, but you fall victim to it, like as if the careers are the villains.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Like they are also still children who have been put into an arena to fight to the death.
Yeah.
For entertainment of other people.
Right. Yes. And I'm not trying to like insult anyone's interpretation of the Hunger Games or say that this is absolutely, you're a bad person if you rooted for Katniss, because me too. It's so fun to read the Hunger Games.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really interesting story, of course. But so, okay, so I guess circling back to how we originally got there, like, so did you see yourself in the driver's seat as Katniss? Like, would you have made the same decisions?
Oh.
Or, okay, let me ask you this. Let me back up even further. Do you crave at all the scenarios like where you could conceivably be put into a decision, into a situation where you had to make the right decision, which is a hard decision?
Oh, I don't know if I crave that. There's certainly like times where I feel like when I'm watching like post-apocalyptic stuff, where I'm like, I feel like I would thrive in a post-apocalyptic world.
Right.
Like man, yeah. I wouldn't have to deal with all this stuff. It would just be like just surviving. I feel like I would be so good at surviving.
Right. Yeah. Well, I feel like there's maybe something to be said, and this is almost like the hierarchy of needs, I think, when it comes down to it, is that, you know, like, at the bottom of the pyramid is the most essential things in your life, like food, water, shelter, you know, and then, like, as you move up the pyramid, eventually you get to things like, I want a really cool mountain bike for my own personal entertainment.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of like, well, that's not really, you know, like, that big of a need. I've always wondered if there's an inverse relationship as you go up the pyramid of the hierarchy of needs with the fulfillment that you actually would receive from accomplishing that thing. So like the higher up the pyramid you go, the less fulfillment you actually get from anything, versus like in a very primal survival situation, the idea of like finding food on a given day, or, you know, like building a shelter that you perceive to be safe, being like safety, you know,
right.
Like physical safety.
Right.
You know, it's like there's, I think that is where, when I daydream about like one of these like worlds that you might live in, it's almost like, okay. If I could like build a bunker that would be like safe from animals on the ground or something like that, you know, like, but also provide protection from the elements. Like the idea of accomplishing that would be so endlessly fulfilling.
I totally see where you're getting at. My suspicion is that the pitfall here is that you're thinking about this as someone who is further up the pyramid already.
Right. But exactly.
Like, if you're the idea of being like feeling fulfilled or like feeling accomplished, if you're at the bottom level, is not a luxury you even have.
Right.
You're not like building. You're like, look what I did. If you're, because you can't, you're so low on it. It's not, there's no feeling of accomplishment. It's just that I had to do this.
Right. Exactly.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. It's
right.
Like,
so maybe that's like the idea of seeking fulfillment maybe is like in itself is a luxury.
Yeah, I think that's, yes, that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay, okay, yeah.
Interesting.
It is an interesting thing. And it's also fascinating because I think it can be, at least a little bit, it can be like a plight, you know, like a sense of being underfulfilled in life, you know, where it's like, oh, like maybe the job that I'm doing is not like bringing me a sense of purpose or something. I don't know.
All right.
It's a thought experiment.
There we go. We're getting deep with Ben again.
All so right. That seems like a perfect time to transition to yet another acrostic.
All right, this is like our little tangent points.
This is our tangent points. Yeah, if we get too deep into a topic, news is we can just like hard turn ourselves out of it.
Right. See, people are always like, I don't know if I'm into poetry, but look at all these deep conversations these poems are bringing us to.
Precisely.
Exactly. Precisely. And these aren't even that serious of poems. Or are they?
They're pretty serious. Let's see. This is going to come from Anna Durand. Here's the name Benjamin. Button. Engineers. Noticing. Jealous. Angry. Meatballs. In. Neckties.
So wait, they each have a period after every word as I'm reading it on the page here?
Yes, which is why I delivered it in such a way.
But to me, it's all just one sentence. Button engineers noticing jealous, angry meatballs in neckties.
Oh, so like, button engineers are like, so the buttons are the engineers.
No, I think these are engineers of buttons, like button engineers. Like, what do you do? I'm a button engineer. Like, I build, you know, I work on buttons.
No, but see, I hear an engineer that is a button, like almost like the jelly beans inside of like Inside Out. It's like a small circular object with four holes drilled in it and two eyeballs, and that's an engineer. The button itself is the engineer. You're hearing it as an engineer of buttons.
Yeah, I'm also kind of imagining, like the guy who comes and installs the new, Inside Out, they come and install like a new control panel at the end.
Yes.
Yeah, the guy who installs it would be a button engineer because he worked on all the buttons.
But is he shaped like a button?
Doesn't have to be.
Well, I feel like he does.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so...
Why are the jealous, angry meatballs in neckties?
So button engineers noticing jealous, angry meatballs in neckties. This, to me, seems like the button... So it sounds like the jealous, angry meatballs in neckties are...
I feel like they're the
Who
suits.
Are they jealous of? They're like the suits, yeah.
They're the suits, yeah. So
yeah.
The button engineers, the boots on the ground, so to speak, maybe. Like they're the ones out installing the buttons.
Yeah.
Whilst being shaped like buttons.
Yeah.
Are noticing. Okay, interesting.
Like, yeah, what are the meatballs jealous of? The meat, yeah. I'm imagining these kind of just being like guys in suits who are just like, they're like, maybe like seem really successful,
but they're jealous, of the
button engineers. Like they're just looking down at them. They're like, oh man, I wish I did that. I do this and it makes me angry.
CJ, maybe it comes back to the exact same thing. Maybe it's fulfillment all over again.
It is. They're just like, I wish.
Nobody wants to be the necktie. Everybody wants to be the engineer.
Button engineer.
Yeah.
Well, maybe. Let's see what Anna Durand had to say for the Jonathan acrostic. All right, ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Juggling oranges, not apples. Totally honest apples noobs.
Juggling oranges, not apples. Let's be clear here.
Juggling oranges, not apples. Totally honest apples, noobs.
Totally honest apples. So
it sounds like noobs is like a finisher.
Right. Yeah. So the sentence is being directed at the noobs.
Yeah.
And it needs to be clear that they are totally honest apples and specifically not oranges.
Right. Yes. It's two things. Like, these noobs don't even know the difference between apples and oranges. And let's be clear, not honest only, apples.
Not only are they apples, these but they're honest.
These are honest to goodness apples, not oranges, you noobs. Oh man, that's great. That's a pretty good one.
It is a pretty good one. Okay. So what is the importance then of juggling true blue apples, which are red, instead of...
Oh, actually, they are juggling the oranges, though.
Juggling oranges, not apples. Oh, wow, okay. Yeah. That flips everything on its head.
Juggling oranges, not apples. Totally honest apples, noobs. Maybe are they saying that oranges are honest apples? Juggling oranges, not apples. Totally honest apples.
So apples are oranges.
Apples are... We're comparing apples and oranges.
In a way,
and
that makes sense.
Oranges are just honest apples.
Wow.
Wow. Take that, noobs.
This is really deep stuff.
Wow. Okay, okay. Moving on. Sheila W.
Okay, this is Benjamin. Okay. Best expressive normal jokester, acceptable monitor, ice, nausea. love that they used Nosh at the end because that was my closer.
That was your closer.
So, okay, best expressive, normal jokester, acceptable, monitor, iced, nausea.
It just sounds like, yeah, this just sounds like it's just more about you. You're just like the best expressive, normal jokester. You're an acceptable monitor, I guess. And the non-clearness of the ice in your life is bringing you nausea. That's what I'm getting from it.
Or maybe the icing on the cake is nausea.
There you go. All right, and then for Jonathan, we have jabber, overconfident, needling, arrogance, twins, high hand assessment, normal.
Well, this one feels a little more needling.
It does. It feels like it's needling me a little, isn't it?
It does. It does. Yeah. Just a little bit. I don't understand. I mean, we could start calling you Jabber Jay instead of Jazzy Jay.
Absolutely not.
Isn't a Jabberjay a thing from the Hunger Games?
It is. Wow, we've come full circle.
We
have come full circle.
Goodness me. Okay, okay.
Boy, there are so many more of these.
There are so many more.
My goodness. Man, we could probably just keep talking about this. We need a way to decide a winner, basically.
We do. Okay.
Although, okay. Let me say this. Me and you sort of discussed a prize for whoever wins our acrostic poem challenge.
We did.
And I'm gonna segue it.
Whoa.
Yeah. Nice. Whoa, here we go. Because something we have not circled back to in a couple episodes and I think we need to is Ben's one cup life.
Can you
give us the cup date, as it were?
Oh my God, that's perfect.
Right?
A cup date.
I have to give my wife credit for that, which she totally coined that phrase.
Nice job, Beth. Yeah, very clever. Okay, so cup date alert. This is something that Alice and I were doing lots of like cleanup around the house the other day, and we were talking about sort of that like very freeing feeling when you like start to get rid of more things.
Oh, that's great.
Like you sort of like take the stuff that's in your house that you're not touching. And you find like useful places for it to go. Like,
yeah.
Not just like throwing it away, but like, you know, either bringing it to Goodwill or finding friends who like might need those things.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually I had a box of 30 pounds worth of Legos, just basic bricks.
Yeah.
That once upon a time I used to make this conference room table for like a, I don't know. There have been so many points in my life where, speaking of cart before the horse, where I was like basically the only person employed by this company, my company.
Yeah.
And I was able to negotiate with one of my clients to get this like cool office that had like floor to ceiling windows. And it was like, I don't know, it was really awesome. And so I was like, oh man, I need to like deck out this office.
Cool office.
I gotta have a really cool office. So like literally in a job where I was never taking meetings or anything, I felt the need to go through and build a conference room table, buy a couch and like armchairs and a coffee table and have like a water cooler and like all this stuff.
Right.
So that like I had like a real office.
Yeah.
And it was like literally for no reason at all. Like there was no one who was attending this particular, you know, space.
Yeah.
I wasn't taking meetings. And one of the things that I saw, because I wanted to be super clever, was people who made conference room tables where the entire surface of it was like Legos, like connected sideways. So you have like a flat surface. It's not like the nubbins facing up. It's like whatever. So anyway, I went on Twitter and was able to find someone that I was able to ship the entire box of Legos to.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is so nice. I was able to take something and send it to someone who's going to like super appreciate it.
Yeah.
And now I don't have this like giant box of Legos.
Your house weighs 30 pounds less.
It does, which is good. It was weighing too much as it was. So anyway, Alice and I were talking about it. The reason I bring that up because we like this idea of almost even paring down to having like two plates that we like leave in like our main cabinet each. So like we both have a plate.
Oh.
We both have like our cup.
Okay.
And so the whole idea has been like, you know, basically, are there ways to go through and take the number of decisions that you're making on a regular basis, like out of play?
Well, that is really the goal. And like, I think if people are like wondering, like, why would you want to get rid of stuff? Why wouldn't you just keep it in case or something? It's like the real thing you're doing by like decluttering your life is removing the like mental load of decisions in your daily life.
Exactly.
You know, if you've got, I'm going to use my kids as an example. If I've got, you know, 20 toys on the shelf, that's 20 things you have to put away. And that's 20 things you have to decide where they're going to go at the end of the day. And if you've only got like 10 things, that is literally half, you know, and that's great. That's good. That's a lot less decisions. And if you can like work that sort of thing into more areas of your life, you can severely like literally lighten the load on your brain.
Right. Well, and so, okay, this is the interesting thing that I observed about myself over the weekend, because I was cleaning out my basement, which is always just like, you know, kind of sheer pandemonium.
Right.
And the big thing that I was dealing with was like every time I do this, which is probably like 2 to 3 times a year, like I'll go through and like do like a really big deep clean where I specifically take the time to like neatly place things on top of other things and have, you know, like everything in just such a good way, is the idea that like everything has a place and it's in its place.
Right.
But with so many of the random things that you never touch, like a, you know, a box of old puzzles that you might not ever do again, is kind of like they all go into like a stack sort of in the basement, and then randomly there might be that one occasion where you go to get something and you pull like one box out from the middle, and then the whole thing starts like piling on itself and
right,
it becomes this like mishmash of objects.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's because those things don't specifically go there, I was just able to neatly organize things I literally never use.
Right. So that's, and it's so hard to be honest with yourself about whether or not you never use something or whether or not you're going to never use it again, because that is the number one hang up everyone has when you try and get rid of stuff, is the, but what if I need this?
Right.
But like, I could need this, and if I get rid of it, then I won't have it. And it's like, yeah, but it's been sitting there for 3 years and you haven't touched it.
Right.
So
maybe you don't need it.
Yeah. Maybe you don't need it. To me, like, often it seems like, if there's something I come across and I'm like, I forgot I owned this. Like, if you're at the I forgot I owned this stage, great news. You effectively didn't own it anyway.
Right.
That is a great indicator. Get rid of it. Get it gone.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the thing too. So it's like, but then things that I do use on like a not frequently but periodic basis. So like a snowboard, for example, it's like the best thing to do with my snowboard is to like literally have like a mounting system on the wall where like when I get back from a snowboarding trip, I know exactly where the snowboard is supposed to return to. Not just like which corner of the basement has the least amount of clutter in it where I can like go and set it down right, where it won't be actively in my way.
Yeah.
Because that's basically what always ends up happening. I carve paths.
Yeah.
So, like, there's always a path through my basement. You can always walk cleanly through it, but almost always along that path in any direction, there are old party supplies or coolers or, you know, like garland from that time I tried to do that mantle thing for Christmas.
Old party supplies. Because you can use them in the next party.
Exactly. Yeah. We want these 4th of July pinwheels for the future because they were like, such a hit last time.
We got like 10 cups left over. Should we just... We'll use them next time.
We'll use them next time. Yeah.
Have anywhere to put those 10 cups, though.
I know. And that's the thing, is that, like, because it's not something that you're going to consistently go back to and pick up again in the future, it's like it doesn't need a reliable place to be.
Right.
And so then it ends up just being anywhere.
Yeah.
All of this to say, though, that my goal with One Cup Life is to just sort of, like, you know, further do this. And the big thing that I've been doing and struggling with was choosing what cup I felt like was going to make the most sense. And I actually, whilst cleaning, I ran across a water bottle and I was like, man, this could be sort of perfect. So
really?
It's like a stainless steel water bottle, and I can't decide if I'm going to use it yet. I'm still leaning towards my 20 ounce Yeti like Rambler mug, but I kind of want to buy a new one because I want to see how much like damage will come to it, because I sort of love when things are like used.
Right.
Like, I like when things are like very clearly like scraped and bruised, and like, it's like, oh yeah, no, I use it all the time. It's like, that's not an indication of my lack of care for it. It's an indication of my love for it.
So, but let me see if I follow you. You have a used one.
I do have a used one,
but you don't like it because it's already used, and you want a new one to find out how used it can become.
Precisely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
It doesn't, but I'm okay with it. But I did find this other water bottle that Allie gave me, and it's like, I was like really excited about it for like half of a day, because the way that the water bottle is sold, it's like, it looks like a bottle of water, sort of like tall, slender, with like narrows to the top with like a screw cap. But
screw cap.
I know. But the thing about it is that about 2/3 of the way up, you can actually unscrew the top of the water bottle from the bottom of the water bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is specifically for cleaning purposes.
Okay.
So that you could like clean the bottom half like a cup.
Because it does the narrow top.
Because it's got the narrow top. So like otherwise, really all you could do is like fill it with soap, shake it up, pour it out, stuff like that. But you couldn't like actually
scrub it.
Anything other than like a bottle brush in there to clean it. So I was like, this could be kind of cool, though, because if I was drinking something like, you know, a beer or something, I could pour the beer into the top. Because you wouldn't want to drink beer from like a water bottle, I think. I guess it's technically what a beer bottle looks like anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I've got like metal cups I drink beer out of.
Right. Well, so it would be a metal cup, and it would act much more like a pint glass
right.
when it's in its collapsed form.
Okay.
The problem is that the lip on it is like not intended to be a sipping lip. It's made for. It's not really like problematic. It's just a little bit more sharp than maybe you would want it to be.
Okay.
It's not like a blade. I want to be clear. It's like it's rounded, but it's still. I don't know. It's just not right.
It doesn't sound like. It sounds like something you could deal with. For a night, because this was the cup you had
yeah.
that night. It doesn't sound like something you want to deal with at all times, because this is your only cup.
This is your only cup. And that's the thing! It needs to be a cup that can be all cups.
That can be all cups.
It's a very challenging thing. But anyway, long story short, our two favorite acrostics, we are going to send a cup.
A cup!
A cup.
Whatever cup you land on.
Whatever cup I land on.
Will be the acrostic champion.
And then you will have your very own Fred.
Then you can have... Dude, we put up... I think it was in our Frozen video last week discussing how the trolls are villains.
Yes.
And there was a shot of you with your dogs waiting for the mail as part of the brand deal for that video. And you had a coffee cup with you. And so many comments were like, is that Fred? Is that Fred? Oh man, is that the cup?
No way!
Yeah. It's very exciting to see the little kernel out there in the comment section as well, because I think of, like, in my mind, it's like there's crossover between the pop and the channel, like,
oh, I know,
like, of course there is.
Of course it is, like, the primary place we've advertised it.
I would love to hear from you, though, if you discovered the pop independent of Super Carlin Brothers, the YouTube channel. Like, if you're a listener and you, like, came across this podcast without knowing that we are YouTubers, that would be fascinating.
That would be fascinating, because it is something that I feel like every time we talk about our job as YouTubers, I feel like I need to clarify, like, the Super Carlin Brothers YouTube channel. Like, as if, like, there's a very strong possibility that you listening at home might not know that.
Right.
But then at the same rate, it's probably, at least within the realm of the internet, most likely the thing you would know us from.
It's probably you came from there to here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe not.
Maybe
at
not.
At some point, this is its own entity.
Oh.
You know? It's exciting.
It's super exciting.
Yeah.
It's super exciting. Okay. So I want to read you two of my favorites. Both of these were from Claire Isbitz.
Okay.
I think these came out really nicely, and they put them in like a fun little like pictographic sort of different colored
text. Oh, I see. Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. So for Benjamin, we have beers and... beers.
Beers.
Got beers on the brain, apparently.
Yeah.
Bees endure nausea just as men investigate narwhals.
It's like the way in which men try and get to the truth about the narwhal is the same way in which the bees are like, I am so flying at these speeds. Gotta just, boy.
It also just makes me happy that they use nausea again.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's such a good one.
Yeah.
Also, I feel like a really interesting thing about narwhals is, I'm not sure if this was a joke documentary or a real documentary, you know, from National Geographic. It was about, like, a group of...
Narwhals?
Narwhals.
A pod.
A pod.
As they're known in a group in their fictional existence.
Okay. Well, so there are rules about hunting narwhals.
Sure.
Because I think in order to protect, like, the species as they exist
yeah.
or don't exist out in the world.
Exactly.
And so, like, if you are to hunt them, there are these, like, very, very, very specific terms. Like, you have to be using, like, a man-made kayak, and they use, like, a buoy system where it's, like a sea otter's pelt that's been, like, inflated.
Oh.
And I think that, like, it actually is this process of, like, spearing it, but then preventing it from being able to, like, swim down by, like, the buoy system or something like that.
Oh, it's like how they catch Jaws.
Yes.
They, like, harpoon them with kegs.
Well, maybe that was somehow inspired by narwhal hunting.
Hot air otters.
Hot air
otters. Otters, as it were.
Otters. But the interesting thing about it is that the...
seems really cruel to the otters.
It seems very... I mean, I think that it sounds very cruel, but the whole idea is that a single narwhal is all you can hunt, one, and it can feed, like, an entire tribe for, like, a huge period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, like, really bizarre characteristic of narwhal skin that it is, like, shockingly high in vitamin C.
Sure.
Like, which is just sort of a rare vitamin to find in natural
right.
living things.
It's like an honest apple.
It's like an honest apple. No, quite literally, though. So they say that, like pound for pound, there is, I think, more vitamin C in narwhal skin than there is in an orange.
An honest apple,
okay. To be clear. All of this I just found really, really, really fascinating. That is weird. I wonder. Interesting.
Huh. So. All right. Well, speaking of narwhals, Claire Isbit's Jonathan Acrostic also mentions them.
Oh, okay.
It actually mentions otters, too. Wow. Okay.
How about that?
What do you know?
this is actually a really funny acrostic.
It's a really funny
given
acrostic.
The information I just gave.
It is. Oh, my goodness. My microphone just fell apart. I'm going to hold it. Here's the acrostic. Joyful otters never attack the hungry auburn narwhals.
Well, not directly.
Oh, goodness. That is... Joyful otters never attack the hungry auburn narwhals. It sounds like a proverb or something.
It does.
Like, what's your read on this situation, guru? It's like, well, the joyful otter never attacks the hungry auburn narwhal. It's like, oh, what does that mean?
But what is it? What does that mean? Are we the otters or are we the narwhal?
Yeah. It sounds like you want to be the joyful otter. Like, if you want to be a joyful otter, don't attack the hungry auburn narwhal. Everyone knows that. You know?
Well, how very interesting. I'm actually sort of blown away that we just told an entire story about otter skins and their role in capture of a narwhal.
Well, yeah. Yeah, this is what happens to those otters.
Those are not joyful
those
otters.
Are not joyful otters. Oh,
that's,
man.
That's how the specific otters are chosen is the shared...
The hungry auburn narwhal... Sounds so much to be like, it reminds me of like that episode of SpongeBob where they have the Alaskan bullworm or something.
Oh, right. Yes,
one?
I do.
Yeah. Was there a third modifier? An Alaskan bullworm? I feel like there was. I don't know.
You would remember.
I would remember. I'll look it up while you talk about things. No, it's just Alaskan bullworm.
That's it.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay. So last one that I feel like I need to read here. There was one from our pair from Madison Gibson. We'll start with you because that's the order that Madison went in. So Jonathan stands for juice, obviously not a Turkish hazard, also nausea.
Oh, the nausea returns.
The nausea returns.
The nausea is everywhere in these acrostics.
Nausea always returns, doesn't it? It really always does. Actually.
I've thought this before. It's like, you have not thrown up for the last time.
Oh, don't say that.
It's like, huh. Is that true?
It's
probably.
Like you never get to overcome.
Yeah. I mean, at some point you will have, but probably
also,
not yet.
Also kind of sad.
Yeah. Also, yeah. Ugh.
This is actually, like, I remember, I think in year one of Super Carlin Brothers, I made an entire video about, have you already lived the best day of your life?
Oh my gosh. What a depressing thought.
Well, it is, but it isn't. I guess it really just depends. Like, it's because, like, the best day of your life is such a good day. It's like something you get to have.
Yeah.
Like, you're always aspiring to have the best day of your life.
Yeah. So you wake up every morning like, maybe today.
I don't know if I wake up every morning thinking like, maybe today.
This could be it. I'm going to walk outside and find $100 bill.
Is that what would make you have the best day of your life?
I feel like it would be a real good starting point if I just walked out my door and was like, jackpot!
Things are going well for Jazzy J to J today.
Jazzy J to J!
J. No, but I feel like it's an interesting thought because I guess what maybe even makes it sadder would be potentially the thought that you didn't realize at the time.
Sure. It feels like almost definitionally you couldn't realize at the time because if you were like actively thinking about it, I feel like that would undermine it. Like, this is the best. This is the best it's ever going to be right now.
Right, right.
That would be taking away from your enjoyment. Like, you'd have to be blissfully enjoying it.
Well, so do you ever have moments like this? Like, I think every once in a while, like when the GMA gets together or something like that, like I will almost like step back a little bit and just like take in the room and almost be like, man, it is not common when I get to be around all of these people at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I do try to like almost actively savor it inside of the moment so that I can like almost like really appreciate the good thing for it's happening.
Right.
But I guess you're right. Like, it does make me wonder almost like, does that take away from it? It's better to just like to live purely in the moment.
Purely in the
like
moment.
That? Or is it more of an indication that like you had the time to step back and think about it, meaning maybe you weren't fully engulfed?
Maybe. Yeah.
That's an interesting thought.
And say, yeah, stop reflecting, Ben.
I can't help it.
Me and Mike and John are over like, what is Ben doing again? He's just like staring into space.
Kind of like mystified.
Is he drooling?
What do you think he's thinking about?
Nausea.
Nausea. Oh my gosh. Oh man. Okay. Well, I feel like we've. Oh wait, no. I'm sorry. I'm gonna read mine as well
Madison Gibson.
From Madison Gibson. So this is Benjamin to close out the day. Bumblebee enchanted nymph, just a mighty island nausea.
All the nausea.
All the nausea.
Bumblebee enchanted nymph. Okay.
So Buzzy Bee, is that like where the bumblebees come
from?
Oh,
maybe.
I feel like it's interesting how much our acrostics influence the acrostics that have been sent to us so far.
Okay, speaking of which, the one you did last week about that ended in nausea about like berries energized.
Hold on, yeah, let's try to remember. Berries energized, never mind. Jam?
Yeah, jam actually.
Makes it nausea.
So,
is that right?
I'm trying to, how do you spell your name?
B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N.
Yeah. Jam actually makes it nausea. Is that right?
I think that's it.
Well, anyway. So we had several people design or put that poem on like a very like nursery looking like piece of artwork or like draw it up.
Yes.
As if you might hang it in a nursery or something. And in such a way that people would like maybe see it but not read it.
Yeah.
It was so funny. Like they executed it so well.
That it's so, this actually is almost like a good way to like maybe like troll your friends and family and stuff, is to almost be like, yeah, like put something like that on the wall and just like wait for the first person to be like, what is this nonsense? like how long does it take for someone to actually pay attention to your artwork enough?
You need like a passive aggressive like thing on the wall that's like that you never bring up, but when someone finally realizes it, they're like, oh, like it's like yeah, like something like this where it would go unnoticed. You probably wouldn't read it, but if you did, it would say like, yes, I am mad you're not using a coaster or something, you know?
Oh my gosh, that is so funny.
Right? Like,
like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Or like, can you please pay attention to the conversation? Or
right.
Like something that like would suggest that the person was clearly like zoning out. And
right. Yeah. Not. They're like, yeah, stop reading the sign and pay attention, dummy.
Dummy.
Yeah.
Classic.
Classic
insult.
Oh, goodness man.
Me. Okay, guys. Well, we had so many acrostics that we need to dig through. We will go through and pick winners and announce them next week on the pop.
Yeah.
Okay. So
the
if you
winner
guys,
of whatever cup Ben lands on to be his one true cup.
My one true cup.
His one true Fred.
My one. Ah, Fred, the best. Otherwise, guys, I want to give a huge thank you to the following patrons who have just started supporting us or have been supporting us over on Patreon, including Nolan Faber, Shalice War, Ryan Rader, Emily, with an exclamation point, Amanda Lance, Marcus Mueller, Edith, Angela Whitehead Ivory, and Emma Forrester. Thank you guys so much for your support on Patreon. If you guys would also like to support the pop, you can do so by going to patreon.com/popcornculture.
Yes, you can choose to, we only have three tiers. You can choose to be on Team Jazzy J, Team Buzzy B, or Team No Host, which why would you want to do that? Because then we just have to open every episode with just 15 seconds of complete silence instead of one of us hosting, which is what you're voting for when you sign up for Patreon. And you also get access to After the Final Pop, a show we record after this show.
Yeah.
And just like 10 more minutes of content for you.
There you go, guys. So be sure to check it out. Again, that is patreon.com/popcornculture. Otherwise, until next week,
pop, pop!